talking about demons. What are the demons?
Voices.
Tell me about them. What are the voices about?
It's another voice, the evil side.
Jeff, whatever your name is, Satan.
Welcome, folks, to Evil Examined. If you guys haven't checked out the website, do so, because we have more articles posted up there, as well as YouTube videos now. We're official tissue. Today, we have the evil entry, which is going to be...
We're switching it up. It's me doing it this time.
Surprise!
Because last time, if you guys didn't notice, we really didn't say anything about it on the last episode, but I did the Forbidden Five, and that's the first time you haven't done the Forbidden Five.
I know. I feel like I got separated from like a child or something that I raised.
Did I do it justice at least, though?
You did a great job.
Oh, thank God. Yeah. And we have another useless individual in the studio. Snodgrass has joined us again. Some valuable insight on this, as you worked at clubs before and gay bars, didn't you?
Just the stable.
Yeah.
And it was just a temporary gig.
No, we're not talking about where you're a customer. We're talking about where you work.
Oh, where I worked. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
No, but he worked at, what, you worked at the Strand, right?
For a while? Yeah, I did work at the Strand. Yeah, definitely. I worked there for a couple of years, 97 and 98, I worked at the Strand, and... it was really cool, man. I was a stagehand there, and I used to work on stage with these rock bands. My mother's best friend's husband was a stage manager, and I was telling him I needed money one day, and he said, yeah, if you come work at the Strand, back, he's like, it's $125 cash a night. You probably work about 12 hours, and that equaled out to about $10. And so I'm like, hell yeah, I need money, man. You know, at the time, I was, you know, in college and shit, trying to, you know. So, yeah, but... It was cool.
That sounds like a fun gig.
Oh, yeah. And, yeah, we're going to get some more. We don't want to give everything away yet, but we'll get some more insights from you, as you are pretty knowledgeable in the station nightclub fire.
Yeah. Yeah, I did have some,
personal insight, huh?
Personal insight, right.
Yeah. Bless you.
Oh, thank you.
I'm probably
I feel like the Holy Spirit tried to come out of me right there.
The least amount of personal insight into this, but... Not being from here, but down the street from where we're recording right now, actually in West Warwick, Rhode Island, there's a nice like park-like memorial that I used to think was a skate park before I looked at it closer or anything, commemorating the lives of 100 victims that lost their lives, along with many more that were injured. And it stands in the place of a fire that spread very quickly at a rock club called The Station on February 20th, 2003. So I wanted to start this by having you guys watch this video. It was taken by Brian Butler on that night, and we'll get into details on everything about the fire later on. But for now, I just want you guys to keep an eye on the clock and kind of pay attention to how quickly this spread throughout the building, and imagine yourself, because we've all been to so many shows and things like that, and small shows, in where all different kinds of venues. Just imagine yourself being in the audience, and there's not going to be sound, I don't think, to this one, because I don't think we're actually... There might be to it. I haven't listened to it yet. But if you can, just describe what's happening for people that can't see it as it's going on. Feel free to as you want to.
Yeah, I can tell you, if there is sound, the screams are horrific. there's a lot of irony and, you know, unfortunate circumstance that is to do with this video.
So there's no sound, but you can see the band on stage. They've got their pyro going. People are, it's pretty crowded, right? They're holding up their beers. Everyone's really into it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Looks fun.
Yeah, we've got three pillars of pyro, one shooting straight up and the other to the left and diagonally to the right.
Got Jack Russell, the lead singer of Great White.
So we can see the cameraman, obviously, very, very intelligently gets the fuck out of there and notices pretty quick he's already backing out. And now it seems like the rest of the crowd's really getting the seriousness as the flames are engulfing the whole stage. This is just 30 seconds in.
So people are starting to figure it out that they're not watching the band anymore. They're trying to come towards the door, the front door of the building. It's very crowded.
Yes, and this is where the bottleneck occurs. You know, just a jam of people that are all trying to get out at once. And here comes a real thick amount of smoke as they're nearing toward the door. We're 1 minute in right now.
Where's the band get out?
There's a different door. I'll talk about the doors later, too, but there's a different door in the back that's a band-only door. And look at the flames here. They come out of the building. The windows are painted black, so it's hard to tell what's going on. There's really dark black smoke coming out of the windows, like really, really dark. A minute and 30 seconds so far. People are...
Yeah, it looks like human bondage, like... A bunch of people are bound together when you see this bottleneck at the front of the doors.
It's a double door that opens out.
So there was like people flailing and half their bodies hanging out.
Yeah. So
trying to escape.
That's all we really need to watch of it is the first minute and a half. But it goes, there's a little bit more footage. This footage is only allowed to be used for educational purposes, which it is now. For like fire academies and training school. But the more it goes on, one thing that's really, I think, touching to see in the video is how people are trying to help others out. Even though there was that stampede towards the door and people got trapped there, there's snow on the ground outside. It was like February. And people that get out kind of go to the snow to try to like keep their own skin on after being burned alive. There's things dripping on them from the ceiling, like, because they had it insulated with foam, and it's, like, raining black things that, as soon as they touch your skin, are burning you. But people looked somewhat calm at the beginning when they're exiting. It seemed like people were, you know, the ones that are in film anyways that probably made it out alive. It looked like they remained calm until they got stuck and couldn't find a way out. But you see people trying hard to help each other, which I think that's probably... I don't know. It says a lot, I feel like, about Rhode Island is them trying to help each other. But
yeah, I mean, I believe Live Leak has the full video if anyone can stomach it. But it does get pretty horrific towards the end. And you do hear a lot of screams, right? Brennan, I know you've watched the video.
I watched the video for the first time about 7 or 8 years ago. It was a full 10-minute clip. And I didn't sleep that night. Honestly, I did not sleep. My wife said that I was just tossing and turning all night. You know, I emailed it to my buddy, and a few days later, I went over to his house, and he was like, "Oh, thanks a lot, asshole. That video screwed up my whole weekend. I can't, you know, I couldn't sleep." He was like, "It's really disturbing the first time you see it. Now, after the second time, third time, you know, but yeah, it's really, it shows the absolute worst and best of humanity." Kind of like what Katie said, you know, you really see people just pushing everyone out of the way, women, children, well, maybe not, just pushing people out of the way to save their own butts. And then you see people running back into the fire. But yeah, it's pretty wild.
Yeah. So, I mean, I just want to give a little bit of background. This wasn't the deadliest club fire of all time. A club called Coconut Grove, that's actually New England too, post-Prohibition era Boston, ended up resulting in 492 deaths, right? After the way that fire started was there was a sailor that wanted to make out with this chick, so he unscrewed a light bulb, and the person that worked at the club later came came back and he's like, oh, I need to screw this light bulb back in. I can't see it. He lit a match to see him so he could screw in the light bulb again and lit the curtains on fire. The whole club went up in smoke, which is crazy, right? And it's not the most recent fire either. Like in 2016 at Oakland Ghost Ship, which is an art collective that one of my friends used to kind of live right next to and was friends with a lot of people there. Hi, Monica. There was a fire there that ended up like killing like 36 people. So that was a little bit more recent. But this one is one that is close to home. So
is that the Monica I met too?
Yeah.
Hi, Monica.
Hi, Monica. Her friends had actually like played a show there like a few weeks before. And it's like the bands there sleep there too. So it's kind of, you know, but this one, I feel like it's definitely shaped a lot of culture here, is indicative of culture that exists here. But it's definitely, one positive note is that it's helped to improve fire safety. And this, that video that we just watched has helped a lot of people learn from things as terrible as this whole incident was. So the first thing that I want to talk about is the club. So
I'm sorry, before we move on, there's one other one that I wanted, that I kind of just wanted to bring up. And I don't know if you heard about this one. Did you ever hear of the Haunted Castle fire? Mm-mm. So this was at like a Six Flags back in like 1978 or something. And I guess they like, there's actually like a documentary that was done on it that you can watch on YouTube that's cut up into parts. I think it's called Doorway to Hell. So if anyone's interested by these kind of like strange fires, this one's a bit more mysterious too. It's not like they knew why. There had been like some kid that was seen, like a young kid they suspected did it, like a little boy. Like, and he did it intentionally, it looked like. So there's like a bunch of different theories with this one. But if you're interested by the content of our show today, maybe I'll put up the link to Doorway to Hell on the website so you guys can check it out. www.evilexamine.com.
So talking about the club, the station, what do you guys know about the reputation? Because you worked at the Strand at the same time that the station, like a little bit before this happened, right? So what do you guys know about the reputation of the place from before? Had you heard of it growing up or what?
I didn't hear of it growing up, but I heard some of the background information just from knowing about the case. And I know that it had changed ownership a few times and like it's kind of seedy reputation. A lot of noise complaints from the neighborhood, stuff like that. What about you?
Yeah, what I remember about the station was I just remember that a lot of 80s bands would play there. Like, I remember Quiet Riot would play there. I think Anthrax played there once. I never went there. I never really knew anyone that said they had been there or went there, so I didn't really hear a lot. I take it back. I knew one kid that was in a band called The Purple Onion, and they were like an acoustic kind of like band, and he used to live in the same town as me, and he used to play there all the time, and he didn't really say much. But the reputation was basically just, not to be disrespectful, but sort of washed up bands or bands that were sort of, you know, past their prime. Again, like Quiet Riot.
Yeah, like it was a Scarpetti bit of
Petty from HJY actually called it like a few years before the fire, where good bands go to die, which, you know,
yeah.
Oh, man.
Ended up being a little bit too true. So.
Yeah, it's just kind of like a dive, right?
I think so.
Dive for bands is what it seemed like.
Yeah, and like you said, like the actual club has changed names and ownership a bunch of times. Like since World War II, it was actually like a bar for Navy boys or seamen, if you will, called The Wheel. Spin me around.
The Wheel.
Yep, and then it turned into Red Fox, to Cedar Acres Inn, to Tammany Hall, to P. Brillo and Sons, which was actually when it was most successful because it was an Italian restaurant where they would sell spaghetti by the pound. Then it became Glenn's Pub, then Cracker Jack's, then the Filling Station, and ultimately the station. The reason I want to point out how many times that it changed hands is because it got remodeled pretty shoddily in between each time. So it's like if you're thinking about building codes and things like that, like and how many times things change and people just trying to make a quick buck and turn something around, buying a place, and renovating it.
It's like a Frankenstein building, right?
Yeah.
Patchwork from all different eras.
Mm-hmm. And it was owned by this guy named Villanova, who was the owner of the building. And he would, like, rent it out to these people that are like, oh, I have this dream of owning a rock club, because who doesn't have that dream, you know? And he'd kind of established that pattern of renting it out to all these different people that would wind up owing him back rent, not being able to pay it. And ended up getting rented to Mike and Jeff Derderian. What do you guys know about them?
Derderian.
Well, what I know is what I read in the book, mm-hmm. Killer Show. Pretty much that book talked about them. I know one of the brothers was a reporter in I think Boston or Providence or both.
Mm-hmm. That was Jeff.
That was Jeff, yeah. But as far as reputation, like local stuff, I don't recall having any.
I know that they definitely were known for like stiffing bands.
Mm-hmm.
So like bands would come to try and play and stuff, and they wouldn't pay them what they were told to, and like oftentimes there'd be like arguments about it.
Yeah.
Also, like, I think they were like kind of politically involved with people around the town and stuff like that a little bit, and trying to, you know, avoid the noise ordinances and stuff that neighbors were complaining about.
Mm-hmm.
So you probably have more of the specifics on it, but definitely not. They didn't, from what I understood, they didn't rub me as like upstanding citizens, kind of shady people.
Yeah, but wealthy though too. Like Jeff, even for being a TV reporter, his brother Mike was actually considered the more successful of the two because he owned a lot of different businesses. He had a plane. He like for his wife's birthday, he would buy her a Mercedes. So, you know.
A Mercedes. Oh, baby, don't worry. I'll put a bow on it.
But yeah, terrible reputation for business and dealing with different people and stuff. And like you said, the neighbors around there. So I used to live in West Warwick, too. So there was one neighbor right behind this club that had changed hands so many times. It's like, why don't you freaking move? It's been like this. You probably knew it was like this when you moved in there.
Mm-hmm.
But he would complain constantly all the time. So now I want to get into the band a little bit. Like, so what can you tell us about your experience with Great White?
Yeah, definitely. Like I mentioned in the intro, I worked at the Strand Theater as a stagehand in 97 and 98. And I was like 18, maybe close to 19 years old. And my mother's best friend's husband was the stage manager there, and he's like, yeah, Brendan, we need some help. You need money? I said, yeah, I need money. He's like, all right, come on down, like, whatever, Thursday night, I forget. He's like, just show up at the back door, knock on it, come on in. So I knock on it. They're like, oh, who are you? I'm like, oh, Damien's the stage manager. I'm here to work. I'm the new stagehand, Brendan. They're like, yeah, come on in, Brendan. So I go in. I'm like, so who's playing? And they're like, Rainbow. And I'm like, what? Fucking Rainbow? And if no one knows Rainbow, man, they were a hard rock band from the 70s, man. They were a kick-ass band, but they're not a household name or anything. But I'm like, holy shit, I remember Rainbow. The singer was Ronnie James Dio. You know, guitarist is Richie Blackmore. I'm like, all right, wow, cool. I'm like, how are they? They're like, that kind of dicks. Just, you know, just don't make a lot of eye contact. Just kind of do your job. And I'm like, all right, well, who's opening? They're like, Great White. I'm like, Great White? No fucking way. My sister had the T-shirt in high school. I knew Great White. Once Bitten, Twice Shy, and Rock Me, and Desert Moon. I knew all those songs. I'm like, holy shit, I definitely know Great White. Like, this is going to be pretty cool. They're like, yeah, man, all right, yeah, it's probably going to be about a 10 to 12 hour day. Might be a little longer, you know, is that okay? I'm like, yeah, no problem. So they come on, they played in front of maybe 200 people, not a lot of people. And I remember, but I asked them before the show, I said, how's Great White? They said, they're the nicest guys you're ever going to meet. They said their road crew are the nicest guys you're ever going to meet. These guys are fun. These guys are cool. They're respectful. They're polite. They're the nicest guys. Sure enough, they came in. They were the nicest guys. They just came in. They were very polite. I remember after the show, I was walking down a flight of stairs. It went like up like two or three stories to the dressing rooms. And I was coming down, and the guitarist was sitting there watching Rainbow. And I said, hey, man, that was a really good show. And he's like, oh, thanks, man. Thanks a lot. And he shook my hand, and you can just tell he was a really nice guy. And I just went, you know. So at the end of the show, anyone in that industry will tell you that what bands do is always, it's called swagging the crew. So they give the crew members, the local crew people, a t-shirt. And it's just, not all bands do it. It's just something they do as a show of goodwill. So Great White gave us these long sleeve, like $35 high quality shirts. And these guys probably made, you know, not much money. These guys probably don't make much money at all. But I remember I worked there for the next 2 years, and a lot of bands came through, like Foo Fighters, Marilyn Manson, like a lot of like big name, pretty kind of bands. And I look back after it was done, I was like, Great White was the most generous band. They were the nicest guys. They gave us the highest quality shirts. Everyone else gave us these shitty $5 t-shirts. I said, but I just had nothing but good memories of Great White. I was like, okay, cool. And, but yeah, that was my personal story about Great White. And then like 6-7 years later, the tragedy happens. And I'm like, holy cow, man. You know, it just brought me back to that. And but whatever, yeah.
Were you going to ask this? And if you're planning on asking it later, we can wait, but... Were you going to ask a question like, where were you when it happened kind of thing?
Oh, you can answer that.
Because I was just curious, because I remember mine pretty... Do you remember when you heard it?
Mm-mm.
What about you?
Yes, I was sleeping. It was like 9 in the morning. My stepfather woke me up, and he said, okay, I just wanted to make sure you're okay. Your mother just called me, wanted me to check on you. She said there was a fire in West Warwick. A bunch of people got killed. I'm like, what? Holy cow. So she goes, yeah, she just wants to make sure you weren't there. You know, she wants to make sure you weren't at the show. So that's where I was.
My story, it's interesting, I felt, because, like, I was working at a tomato sauce factory at the time. And so I walked in, and I'm just, you know, taking pallets of tomato sauce and palletizing it. And the only thing we had was the radio, you know, in there to get us by. And, like, I just remember... You know, they'd play a few songs, and then an update would come on, and they'd be like, they pulled out 20 people from that building. And then a couple more songs, they'd come back. They're like, now it's up to 37. And it just kept getting higher and higher and higher. And I just couldn't fucking... By the time it got to 100, I was like, is this going to stop? You know what I mean? Like, do I know anybody that's in there? That's, you know, that's like what it... was moving to, because it's just like, it's just weird just hearing the number continuously climb like that.
I think it was CNN had it on, and I was following it because I was working third shift at the time, and so it was like 9-10 in the morning. And I was doing the same thing. I was like, well, how high is this gonna go, man? I remember when it was at like 90, and I was like, yeah. Man, how much, you know?
You're like at 90, dude.
Yeah,
we're a small state. You know what I mean? So it's like, I mean, well, even for a big state, that's an epic tragedy, but.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly here, it seems even larger.
Yeah, I think they had, like, there's a huge parts of the book that call out the club's capacity and what the fire marshal and everyone said was okay to have in the club, right? Because it's not a very big place, like, you know, it's not like a huge club. I think there were like almost 500 people in there, like 496, something like that. Or no, that's how many people died in that other thing. There were like almost 500 people there. And I think the capacity, like it was like 200 people over capacity or something like that.
Yeah, so. It was ridiculous. And wasn't that part of like the sort of political aspect too? Like they were getting...
Like favors.
Favors, like, right? Kind of?
Buddy, yeah, a little bit, yeah.
I know one ironic part that's stuck with me was there was a pool table in the middle of one of the rooms, and the pool table took up, I want to say, the space of 15 people from a zoning perspective. So they said, well, we'll move the pool table to the side of the room, and that opens up the 15 spaces. How does that work? Make sense, yeah. Right?
Still because in the room.
Right, so yeah. Shit like that was happening, like you said,
like political. Dumb logic.
Just dumb logic, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Back to Great White. So yeah, like you said, they're a huge band. And it's interesting because that's where most of this information I'm getting is from, that killer show book that's written by an attorney for, like, you know, the plaintiffs that sued a bunch of people after this tragedy, right? Like victims, families and victims.
John Baralek.
Mm-hmm.
If you guys are interested in the book, it's Killer Show by John Baralek. Great. It's a great book.
Yeah,
I thought it was
really well written.
Yeah. I think some of it reads a little bit like fiction too. Like, mm-hmm. They put you in the shoes of people And if you don't know anything about the case, you're kind of wondering if these people are going to walk away from this or not.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many little insignificant details that cause people to do one thing or another. So it's a very interesting read for any of our listeners.
Yeah. And one of the things is like you're saying about how nice the band is and how nice everyone that works with the band is. It's weird because it's like they're simultaneously painted in like, it tries to be objective, but it's like they're painted in a light where it's like they are really nice to people and they want to put on a good show, but they're also negligent in what they're doing and how it can affect other people and somewhat, if not extremely criminally responsible for what they did. Just by having pyro where they shouldn't have. So one thing is that Great White was actually two different bands at this point. So there was like Jack Russell's Great White, which was the band that was playing by the front man because he had a like huge spat with like the rest of the band. And the other band was just called Great White. So he's already gone through like all these legal battles and he tried to put out a solo record too. And so going from like this huge fame, his solo record called For You only sold about 770 copies nationwide. So, I mean,
wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
So not doing that well. That's why I was like, when you're saying that they gave you guys like the long sleeves and everything too, like for merch, the way that they're portrayed is by like he went bankrupt. Like he lost everything. He didn't have anything. It said he didn't even pay the guys that he worked with. So, I mean, in the other people in the band were contracted out. They weren't the other members of the band. They weren't allowed to like produce anything as Great White themselves or like release anything or get any money from it. They were just like, I don't know, like subsidiaries basically. Like they didn't get anything out of it. Yeah.
It's like, oh, you're getting paid by show and that's it.
Right.
Kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And so...
Well, he was probably... Like, it sounds like he was really generous in his better times, right? Because was that... Was when you saw him, was it Jack Russell's Great White or was it just
Great White? I think it was just Great White, yeah. It was a lot of the originals, yeah.
So probably back then, you know, he wasn't in such a slumped position. And mm-hmm. maybe now he... Like, well, not now, but then later on, he was trying to catch up.
But he still wanted, it seems like he still wanted that rock star lifestyle and still wanted to be nice at the same time, like was still very giving and generous. Like a little bit later, we're going to talk through like some different people and how they ended up getting to the show. And a large number of people were invited by the band themselves, were just put on the guest list. So it's like, that's even more like, I mean, no matter what, everything is tragic about it. But, like, to be invited by a band, it's, like, an honor. And then to be burned alive.
Right. It's like,
terrible.
We'll take care of you. Just come to the door, you know?
Yep.
And then that happens. It's sad. Mm-hmm.
So they had a manager whose name was Dan Bichel. And he was obsessed with pyro. Like, he would do it at home and things like that. And they were touring. And they wouldn't know until the day of the show if they were going to be allowed by the venue to have pyro or not. Right? And so they would just kind of like throw it together. But just picture that, like, that's how quickly they're planning these things. You know what I mean? And you're supposed to have permits to be able to do it. Another buddy-buddy, like, don't ask, don't tell sort of situation. But the station would actually encourage bands to have pyro at their show because it would draw crowds. And it's, I mean, I'm not going to lie, it's fucking fun to watch. Like, pyro's cool shit.
We were at WrestleMania. The pyro there was unbelievable. Yeah. And the atmosphere that it provided us, it's just nuts, dude. Mm-hmm. Like, it really does add another level.
Yeah. There's one story of a guy that was actually attending this Great White show, and his band, I can't remember what they're called right now, had played at the station, and he was doing, like, self-made pyro, and his bass player was in a wheelchair, and while he was doing his self-made pyro, he lit this guy playing bass's hair on fire and had to, like, pat it out while he was there, and dude couldn't pat it out. He just kept playing his instrument himself. So, I don't know. They even... What if you guys had a contract, like, where you got to choose, like, what you want it supplied to you at a venue you're playing at. If you're like a rock god, you know what I mean? Like I want only green M&Ms. What would you put on that list?
Magic mushrooms.
You would play such a good show.
I would, oh man. All right, I'm going to give my fake answer.
what is it called? Hagen?
Hagen.
Like something stupid materialistic like that. I'd probably order, I'd want a couple 4-packs of Focal Banger.
Oh, yeah, that'd be cool, right? Some of the better beer in our region.
Right. Yeah, just because I can't really get my hands on it much, but.
So you're going to bust their balls, make somebody drive all the way up to Vermont. Fucking Vermont. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What a prick. What about you, Mean Gene?
You'll be ill like a massage. That would, you know.
That would be, right?
A PG massage.
Oh! Get all... Yo. Oh, no. Those ones are just...
Are these, like, all shook up?
They're all pyro. Up?
We just had a beer go off. Oh, it's all over my fucking cock now.
Like, Katie, what would you get?
Well, after you said massage, I started thinking, like, I would want just a souvenir from the place, like some small souvenir I could take with me, like a sticker or something, or like a bottle opener. I don't know. It's kind of cool. Stupid, but Great White, what they asked for, considering what he's in his 40s, right? And this is only for Jack Russell. It's not for the rest of the band. He wanted a nutritious meal with salad, a chicken breast or prime rib, baked or mashed potatoes, and freshly steamed vegetables. That was his list of demands that he wanted. So
boring.
Mm-hmm.
My God.
Yeah. So let's start talking about some of the people that were there and how they wound up being there. So there was Tina Iyer. She was a 33-year-old single mother, and she was actually cleaning a room at Fairfield Inn, which is where Great White was staying. And they just got invited. They're like, saw them cleaning the room. And I'm like, see, that's like freaking nice. Like, if your day starts off that way, like, you think it's going to go well, you know?
Yeah, you're like all excited.
Mm-hmm. Then there was another, they went to Denny's. The band went to Denny's in the morning, too. And there's this guy that walked up to him. And he's like, oh, my God. His name is Rick Sinetti. He saw them. And he's like, oh, my God, you guys are Great White. And they're like, oh, yeah, do you want to come to our show? So just invited a dude that they met at Denny's. They did a radio, like a college radio interview, and they invited the two college kids that interviewed him, right? All these people showed up.
They're like inadvertently the Grim Reapers.
Right? It's like crossing paths with them. You know what I mean?
It's the bad omen.
Mm-hmm. There was a guy that they called, and... Jack Russell wanted to get a tattoo, and so he starts calling this tattoo shop, right? And he invited the tattoo artist, too, because he was like, oh, the guy didn't even believe him. And someone that was with them ended up getting flames tattooed on their arm, too. Just, like, tons of weird ironies throughout the whole thing.
Did that person perish in the fire?
I believe so.
Oh, my God. One thing I wonder, too, is, was there any calculation of injuries? Because I know we have the body count. Or are you saving that for later?
I think it was like in the 200s, but oh, okay. I can't, I don't know.
So it's like almost everybody in the club was scathed at some point.
Yeah, everyone was scarred emotionally or physically or both, so, or definitely both. Another thing was that's crazy about this is the Dirdarians were actually trying to sell the club at the same time, right? Like they just, you know what I mean, like didn't... They didn't even want it anymore. They were trying to get rid of it, get it off their hands. It wasn't making them money or anything like that. Everyone that worked there pretty much worked there for free or for beer, you know, and to get to see the shows. They had, so it's like they're not trained employees. They don't know about fire safety.
Oh, yeah, like the security guards. These are just like guys from out in the alley. You know what I mean? They're like, look, kick the shit out of somebody if they try to come through this door.
Mm-hmm.
We'll let you drink for free on the night. You know what I mean? Like, and we'll give you $20 at the end of the night. Yep. Yeah. It's like a lot of these guys probably didn't even... I know some of them ended up on trial, right?
No, not for the cases that are mentioned in here, but...
But one of the guys that blocked the door, right, or something?
No, he got away scot-free, yeah. I think.
It's the people that got charged for this. I'll talk about that a little bit later, okay. But it's not so much the the employees of the club at all. There are also some other like weird ironies that like happened too. Like Jeff Derderian actually gave he did a report, right? Like 2 days before about fire safety. Like he had a segment called In Case of Emergency, and he was talking about what to do to like avoid smoke inhalation. There had been like a club issue in Chicago a couple of days before that would trigger most people around the country to have like a bunch of people having the same thing where they're stampeding over each other, and a bunch of people died because someone like did pepper spray and it freaked someone out, and all these people like crammed down the stairs and stampeded and trampled each other. And so that would cause most clubs to kind of like have a thought about that in their head, or like to talk about it and be like, this is my escape route. This is what we do in emergency situations here. But it's not like they had meetings when everyone's just like local people.
It's like, okay, after James Holmes shot up the movie theater, the next fucking movie I went to, I was thinking about that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. A tragedy happening in a place. Like, you can imagine if you owned a fucking club and that was big news.
Mm-hmm. Are you not allowed to put sprinklers? Was that before that?
They didn't have money. Sprinklers would have cost them $63,000, so they didn't put them in there. But right
all
after
the lawsuits
this,
cost them more.
Right. I know it's a bunch of like sad things for this one. They got Budweiser and WHJY's Dr. Metal to promote the show too, which I think they paid them like $200 to promote the show and had them give them a free banner or something like that, which ended up making them culpable down the line as well for promoting and sponsoring this. Mm. And because you need to go after people who have monies, because the victims of these families are not going to get money from a bankrupt 80s or 90s band and, club owners that are trying to sell it that can't even pay their rent. So go after Anheuser-Busch.
It's a tough thing, though, because, you know, they can't go to every club and inspect it where they're promoting a show.
No.
That's ridiculous to think that they'd be able to do something like that, you know? Like, I get it. Like, it's horrible. People passed away in horrific fashion. And there's costs for their funerals, you know, things of that nature. It's just tough when you see them, you know, the lawyers going for...
You are your sponsor, you know what I mean? Like, a little bit. Like, it makes sense in both ways. You could cut it either way.
I don't think so. I think, like, you know, if somebody straps a bomb to a billboard, do we involve the person who's advertising on it? You know, like, it doesn't...
Yeah, but if you read the last part of that book, I'm telling you, it is. I think we talked about it at work a little bit, like, it... This guy convinces you of the culpability and how deep it goes, even though it's like they're just sponsoring the show. You think, you know, they're going to say, hey, we're just going to sponsor the show. But it's a money-making capitalistic venture, and there's certain responsibilities that come with that, commercial speed, you know. I don't know.
I'm saying. You can cut it, like, you can slice it all different ways. You can make it make
sense.
Oh,
no, I can see. No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I agreed with everything you said, but when I finished... I agree with it, but when I read the last couple chapters of that book, it made me think again about it, though.
Yeah.
It was weird.
I was thinking a lot the whole time during this whole thing about the culpability and the criminal charges that are pressed and, like, the monetary fines that people faced, too. So I think, yeah. One thing, too, is the fire marshal after that Chicago thing had said... it was unlikely. His name's Jesse Owens for all of Rhode Island, I guess. He said it's unlikely that something like that would happen here. Like, that was 3 days before it. You know what I mean? Like, just total confidence in the situations and everything that people have in place and that the right people are in place. Yeah. So the... Yeah, so, okay. So the fire took place. That song, Desert Moon, was playing. Do you like that one?
That's like my favorite Great White song. Yeah, I love that song.
So We saw it go down. It took like 90 seconds for people to start really dying, like all the smoke inhalation, no sprinklers. Another thing that was kind of the culprit was, in order to please the neighbors, they had put in this like insulation sound, like polyurethane foam. That's why the smoke was so black, because this stuff not only like lights up quicker and burns hotter, it releases really toxic smoke. And that's what they had put in because it was cheap, and because the neighbor that was complaining about the noise was a rep for this foam place. So, you know what I mean? Another buddy-buddy thing, trying to save a buck, and down the line it ends up costing much more than that. When they started taking the victims out, there was a kind of a thing, too, where even though it kind of seemed to me from videos and things that I watched that people responded quickly, like the fire station's not that far away, but it ended up resulting in a change to how Rhode Island has kind of like people responding to accidents and big events like that. Like, it makes sure that there's intercommunication with like hospitals and ambulances and with fire departments and things like that, instead of just designating one. Like, if a fire department has an ambulance, to just send that one, they'll like talk to each other and communicate more too. So that's something that came out of this as well. But they took a bunch of victims, and they're taking them out like in droves, like you said, how you kept getting like a count updates and things like that. They would take them to local hospitals, but a bunch of people were really severely burnt and ended up having to go to like hospitals in Boston where they could get specialized treatments and things like that. So one guy named Mike Vargas, where he had been at the show, and he was covered by all these dead, charred bodies, and he like wound up like reaching his hand up out of them and grabbing like a firefighter. And while he's like searching through the bodies and grabbing him, and that's how he got found and taken to the hospital too, which I can't even imagine. Jeez. That.
How bad was he messed up?
I think he had his, unfortunately, like, I get names confused, and I know that's like rude of me or terrible of me, whatever. But I think he had his like hand, I don't know if he was like the one recipient of a hand transplant and if he like lost his nose or if that was somebody else. I have a lot of names mixed up in my head for the victims.
It was a lot of,
it's okay. So. It's a lot of, it's fine.
Great White's bus was blocking where the fire truck would have come in and parked too. So there's that. And then there were tons of missing people and a ton of uncertainty. So if like you're wondering where people are, if they went to the show or whatever, like how they're calling you, trying to see if you're there. No one knew who was there, who was okay, because of this mass exodus to all these different hospitals. People didn't know. Later on, after like the fire department had left and gotten like taken care of all the people that were still alive and things like that, they had teams that kind of looked like archaeologists, like digging throughout the whole thing, trying to find any personal effects and documenting everything that they could find, just to have things for like the victims' families and to know who was there for sure.
Well, you know, like it's crazy though, because you just brought up that part about the bus like blocking the fire truck. And then we talked about a little bit before that how they were making safety training videos. Like, the level and degree of irony in this story is just so unbelievable that it's like, if you saw it made as a movie, it's like you wouldn't believe it. You'd be like, that's too unrealistic to make into a movie. That's how crazy the irony is.
Stranger than fiction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not to,
insane. Do you want to read some of these quotes that the people said, like, right after the fire, they're immediately denying culpability?
Yeah, so this is out of chapter 22, Circling the Wagons, out of the Killer Show book. Here's a quote. "We had permission to use the pyro, Jack Russell. While the fire still raged," he said that. "At no time did I or my brother authorize or okay the use of pyro by the band Great White," Jeffrey Derderian, 5 hours after the fire. "Our inspector missed nothing. They were in compliance," West Warwick Fire Chief Charles Hall, 7 days after the fire. "Our officials were doing their customary duty in a conscientious way," West Warwick Town Manager Wolfgang Bauer, 1 month after the fire.
Like, immediately, right? Like,
Oh, yeah. everyone's in save their own ass mode now, you know?
Mm-hmm. So there was a huge public outcry for prosecution after this, right? Like, people lost their family, like, wanted someone to blame, right? And
someone has to be responsible.
At this point, who would you guys blame? Who has the biggest, without going into who they actually
the venue
sued or
owners,
anything.
I feel like.
It would have to be the guy that hit the switch for the pyro.
Oh, it's so tough. So, okay, so I can only pick one?
Just pick one.
If I could only pick one, I'd go with the venue owners too. What about you, Katie?
I would also go with, like, off the rip, I would also go with the venue owners because, like, I wouldn't do that in every situation Yeah, venue owners. It's their responsibility to check.
You make a good point, though, right, with the guy that hit the pyro because it shouldn't have been going. But even if they did hit pyro,
There should have been stuff in place.
Yeah, if there should have been sprinklers or that foam shouldn't have been there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's why I look at it the other way. But yeah, there's so many people.
It could easily go either way. I mean,
but yeah. Like if we're looking at it from the club owner thing, right? The enforcers of that shit are the fire department, right? Mm-hmm. So if you want to take it a step outside the 7 degrees or 6 degrees of separation, right? It could even be the fire department, right? Because the fucking club shouldn't be running if that shit's in place. If they're inspecting it properly. Actually, I'm going with the fire department.
Yeah, because the chief was really confident in that being safe, right? Passing.
He probably was told there's no pyro at some point, you know, like,
but the club's out of compliance.
True.
It's overpopulated, right? Mm-hmm. And
so we all think it's really mutual blame, right? It's hard to say that one person is the most
culpable.
It was
a domino effect.
Yeah. It's a bunch of...
I don't know. I think about it this way. Let's say I'm the guy that's going to flip the switch, set up the pyro and flip the switch. I got to look around. I got to make a judgment call. I mean, everyone makes judgment calls every single day. You know what I mean? Even if you got permission, even if you got a written, signed affidavit that everything's okay, that's the way I'm looking at it.
Club's closed and that guy isn't even there to flip the switch if the fire department does their job. That guy doesn't even get to make that decision.
True, yeah.
But
I think at the end of the day, that split second, I mean, he was the one that hit the switch, though, you know? So I think...
It's crazy. It's an interesting question.
Right.
Because it is open for debate, and there's so many culpable people, you know?
It's like, where does the cart and the horse go throughout the whole thing, you know?
Bottom line, though, they all have blood on their hands on this one.
Yeah, definitely.
And... Okay, so for fires like this where it's not like intentional that you're harming someone, typically what people get charged with is involuntary manslaughter for criminal negligence is how it goes through the courts. So the jurors listened to 10 months of testimony, and the jurors actually asked, Aaron, like you were kind of saying, if the fire marshal for West Warwick, Dennis LaRocque, could be charged too. They asked if he could be charged too, and they didn't get a clear answer, and he was never charged.
Wow.
So what happened was
they thought he was culpable, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, we want his ass too, essentially is what they were saying.
And this is the jurors after listening to testimony. They, you know what I mean, considered him to be at fault. For him, what ended up happening to him was... And I'm not saying that, like, I don't know anything about him or exactly how involved he was throughout, like, checking and things like that. But it's, like, his name on it at the end of the line. Like, how you have to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's the fire marshal for West
Warwick. We know he works some deals, you know? There's evidence to support that, like you said, the bum logic, right? The favors that were done, right? What were some of the other examples? Like, you had the logic, like, oh, we'll move the pool table to the corner.
Mm-hmm.
He let it go over capacity, right? maybe none of this ever happens if it's not over capacity. There's no bottleneck, right? Even if it lights on fire, maybe nobody dies because it's not over capacity and there's no bottleneck.
It's totally true.
That makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, that and could that's make why. It could have made all the difference. I think I want to say they were like a like I don't recall.
It was like 100 over
well may, over 100.
It was one or two. Capacity, yeah. It was one or two, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cuz they said it should have been like 3 350.
3 350.
And they were yeah. closer to 5, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's insane.
That's just scumbags trying to make a fucking extra quick buck.
But it's not
at
like
everyone else's expense.
Fire, it's they were even over what was assigned as their capacity anyways. You know what I mean? So it's not like the fire marshal has to be at every club every single night checking to see if people are at the capacity either. You know what I mean? Like they can go check, right? But it's not like they're going they can't like be everywhere at once.
Yeah, but no, he bumped the number up.
He bumped the number up, but not to as high as people were there. They still went over that number
right,
that he
but,
gave.
But it was over what should have been in the club.
Correct. I'm just playing devil's advocate.
It's true what you say though, right? Like your point being is that if they went over it anyway,
what would
have
stopped
them?
What
would have mattered? Yeah.
So basically what ended up happening to him, he didn't get charged with anything. He was kind of like laterally moved back to becoming a firefighter because I guess he was just like good as a firefighter, you know what I mean? Like the physical parts of it and everything like that.
Certainly not the mental.
Later on he got injured on the job and wound up taking, I think they get 2/3 pay for the rest of your life and don't have to pay taxes.
Was he loafing it or is this a legit injury?
I'm not sure.
You're not sure.
That's just what was in the book. So, and I didn't research further.
Cause we've seen these videos of, allegedly injured firefighters at the fucking gym, putting up 300 pounds on the bench.
Yeah. Oh yeah, opening gyms.
Yeah,
the heavy hitter, Rob Levine. He's on a disability pension. He was a CF cop.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. He has a full pension. He crashed. He cracked up his car. If you don't know, the heavy hitter, Rob Levine, is a lawyer in Rhode Island worth millions of dollars.
He's infamous for his ridiculous commercials.
Yeah,
and the jingle, the heavy hitter is the one for you.
Yeah, yeah, but he served as a Central Falls cop for 5 years, then cracked his car up, and now he's on a lifelong disability pension, in addition to the millions of dollars he makes as a lawyer, and...
Chasing ambulances,
chasing
right?
Yeah, and he gets full health benefits for him and his family for life, which is pretty crazy.
Just,
yeah. Suck
it,
Dick,
amazing Rob. What you can, it's amazing what you can justify to yourself as, you know what I mean? In this whole thing, since it didn't end up going to trial, right? And I guess it was like a pain just to figure out who they were going to try to, you know, put on trial anyways. The victims allowed one speaker per victim, 5 minutes per speaker, right? And they could only speak about their personal impact to themselves. So after this 10 months of listening to everything that happened that went down with the fire, these people that are so severely impacted by it, they are not allowed to place blame or anything like that during their victim statements. They're not allowed to say anything like that. This is the people that were on trial for during this one were Dan Bichelle, who is the band's manager. So he's the pyro. He's the guy that flipped the switch. And the Durdarians, who are the brothers that own the club. So this is the criminal trial right here. So what that wasn't a trial. This is the, you know what I mean, whatever. Like when they're talking about court things, I don't remember the names of things. So that's all they get to say. They have to summarize it in 5 minutes.
Why?
And that's all people are going to listen to because there were so many of them.
But why the restrictions on what they could talk about?
I don't know. The judge ordered that. I mean, they didn't want it to become a circus because it kind of already was a little bit like sensationalized and people are so upset and they just are so angry, right? And justifiably. But I didn't want it to get more media attention focused on like punishments and things like that, I guess.
What a fucking raw deal, huh?
So I watched... I watched the Durdarians give their speeches after, right? After these people are only allowed their 5 minutes. And they got to talk for like 15 minutes each. And they tried to pull a pity card on it. One of them, he was like, I know a bunch of you wished I died in that fire. I wish, you know what I mean? I wish I could have made you guys happy. Shit like that, he was saying.
The fuck up. Wow.
So like
the first that
on almost you a guilt still trip.
Blow your fucking head off now if you want. You know?
I don't think they're probably wishing their fucking family, their loved ones back, not this fucking dumbass. Right?
Isn't the day after it happened he transferred all his assets to his wife's name too?
Maybe. I don't know.
I think that was literally the day he just did a quick deed to the home and everything right into her name because he knew.
They sound like morons. They should have been shit in place anyways for maybe have a physical place of business.
I mean, you could tell.
Put it under your name. You put it under a company's.
Felt bad. You can tell. Yeah. You can tell they felt bad. You could tell that it's like, at the same time, like I tried to like put myself in their shoes and like think about how I would feel, right? Like, what, you're cutting corners. You know what I mean? You're trying to save money, and you have a club where nothing has gone terribly, terribly wrong like that before. Like, how much guilt do you feel for yourself? Like, do you take on that responsibility in your heart?
Yeah. I mean, I get it. Like, it's like, there's too much stuff that I read about them though, being pricks and mm-hmm. stiffing people for money and their attitude. It makes them hard to pity, in my opinion.
When the place was going up in flames, they were yelling at the bartenders, go grab the fucking cash drawers. Don't leave the cash drawers in there. Yeah. You know, stuff like that. Yeah.
I'm not saying I pity them. I'm just asking.
No, but it's a fair question because they're not, unlike a lot of the other people we cover on this show, right? They're not monsters. They didn't go out and stab to death or shoot 100 people, greedy. Right? Mm-hmm. It's just, it was a combination of greed, oversight, the perfect storm, really, you know, for this tragedy.
And the other guy, the band manager, just wanted to put on a good show. He pleaded no contest. He was like, you know what? He took responsibility and he lives with it.
He has every day.
He got sentenced to 4 years to serve and was eligible for parole in 16 months.
The band manager?
Mm-hmm. Jeff only had to do... He didn't have to do any time. He only had to do 500 of community service hours. And during his statement, he had already started doing his community service in a burn victim unit.
Damn.
Yeah.
Now, Jeff was one of the brothers, right?
Yeah. He's the newscaster brother.
So the other one got
so
away?
The other one had to do time.
How much? So he... All right. So while you're looking that up... So... One of the club managers didn't get any time?
I don't remember that, but I guess not, no.
500 hours of community service.
I know one quick little sidebar about the thing. When I talk to people at work about the station at Club Fire, which I haven't done a lot, but, you know, we talk to people from all over the country sometimes. And people have asked, like, about it, and I'm like, well, people don't view it as a tragedy in Rhode Island. They view it as a crime. This was a crime that happened. And one story I have was I was sitting on a jury, and you know, anyone that's been on a jury know, have you or any of your relatives been a victim of a crime? You know, that's what they asked me, and they said, have you, Mr. Snodgrass? No, I haven't. And they asked a woman, and they said, have you or any of your close family members, immediate family or close family members, been a victim of a crime? And she was like, yes, my nephew died in the station nightclub fire. So the whole place just immediately just went completely dead. Like, everyone was just like, you know, and the judge was like, oh, I'm very sorry to hear that, ma'am. But it sort of articulates the thing, though, that people in Rhode Island don't see it as a tragedy or just an accident. They see this as a crime, you know. Mm-hmm. A crime happened.
I can see that. I mean, I can kind of get on board with it to some extent.
Involuntary manslaughter.
Right.
But I think what he's saying though is it's viewed as more than that, almost, probably,
right,
by the victims at least, or people connected to it.
Exactly. You know, like, I mean, when the bridge collapsed in Minneapolis, remember that, or Minnesota, like 10, 12 years ago, it was an accident. Nobody saw it coming. The thing was structurally sound. Something.
Yeah, it's a freak accident.
Freak accident. That's hundreds of people died. Yeah. People just looked at it as a tragedy. This right. was different, though, you know.
Right. There's no, you don't sue the bridge afterwards.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah.
Yeah, that's something that I thought was interesting about this too. Is like, is this because it's Rhode Island? Because looking at some of the other nightclub accidents and things that have happened, you know what I mean? Like, people do get charged eventually, but not quite like this. Like,
what do you mean?
I mean, like, okay, so in the Oakland Ghost Ship one, like right now, actually, I think yesterday, they're trying to get verdicts for like the two people that own and operate it, but it's like, it's an art collective, right? So a lot of times those are like illegal spaces that people are living in, but there's like a mutual understanding with everybody that's there that they know it's an illegal space, but we're artists and we want a place to perform and you guys are providing that. So kind of thing. And it's like, they know it's going to be shitty buildings. Like, you know, a little bit what you're getting yourself into with this one. It's a little bit different. I mean, you don't ever think there's going to be a fucking fire. You know what I mean? But I don't know. That's what I mean.
It's like if you look at the Coconut Grove one you were talking about earlier, like a sailor or someone unscrewed a bulb so he could make out with a girl.
Yeah.
I mean, you could take it to the extreme. Well, what, you know, should the club have had that bulb so it shouldn't have been? If you get into that rabbit hole, you'll never, you know, it's like you can.
So does it have what happened to the other brother?
Yeah. So Mike got... Okay, so, I mean, they all got sentenced to years. I'm just saying that he didn't have to serve anything for Jeff. He only had to do his 500 community service hours. But he did get sentenced to 10 years. Michael got sentenced to 15 years, and 11 suspended, of the years were then. Suspended. 11 of them.
So the first one, all were suspended, and he just did community service?
For Jeff, for yep. Jeff.
Mm-hmm. And then, I'm sorry, his other brother was?
So Mike, he was paroled after serving 27 months. So he's in there for like 2 years plus. And then Dan, who is the band manager that did the pyro, he pleaded guilty. And I'm going to talk about a little bit about their pleas in a second too. So he pleaded guilty to 100 counts of involuntary manslaughter. He was sentenced to 15 years. 11 were suspended, so he got 4 to serve, and he was paroled after serving 16 months or a year and a half. This guy, I don't know. There's something about like how he has acted throughout like everything that makes me think that it's like he, you know what I mean? Like, he knew he didn't mean to do anything.
Yeah,
he lit the switch. He was trying to put on a show.
He has a spine, yeah. And he feels remorse.
So Michael and Jeff, and granted, they were probably told to do this by their lawyers. They didn't plead guilty. They pleaded something called nolo contendere. I don't know how to say it. I don't know Latin like that, which is basically a way of pleading guilty without admitting guilt in Rhode Island. And then Jack Russell, who's the lead singer of the band, and he like is responsible for the band, you know what I mean? Because he had control over whether or not they were going to have pyro too, you know what I mean? It's his band, never charged. He doesn't talk about it. I watched a bunch of interviews with it. People try to ask him about it all the time. He avoids the subject. He meets with like a therapist all the time. And he's like, there's nothing I can say that will give these people any relief. Anything I say, talking about the victims of families and stuff and victims themselves. He's like, anything I say makes them mad. It doesn't matter what it is. Anything I say will make them mad. And then, like we said, Dennis LaRocque, the fire marshal, was never charged.
Damn.
Yep. Then they went on to sue 8 law firms, kind of formed together and made like this giant, like super group of law firms, that this guy that wrote this book was part of, to file a single lawsuit, to kind of work to compensate the victims for, you know, hospital bills, everything they lost, their family members who might've been like the sole income providers that passed away. And they filed against 46 defendants, so it was like the club owners, the band Great White, the manufacturers of this polyurethane foam, the concert promoters like Anheuser-Busch, the insurance companies that had said that they'd done inspections on the place, the town of West Warwick, and they were getting criticized on how many people they sued and how many people they were going after. Like, but like you said, it all ends up feeling super justified because you don't know if you're going to get.
Well, but also you said too, and I didn't really think of it this way, you know, like if it was a sole provider of a family, you know, that's a lot of money that is accumulated over one's lifetime. Like if a guy passes away and he had like two daughters and a wife, you know what I mean? Like you got to take care of those kids still, you know?
And you're fucking tortured every day because your husband died in a fire.
Yeah. It's just,
I didn't think of the insurance company that you mentioned.
Yeah.
It's just a tough one still though. Cause like some of it, like you said, like certain things with advertisers, are you going to go into the thing with the foam specifically?
I was only going to say a little tiny bit about it.
I'll let you say it first before we talk about it then. Cause I don't know what you're going to say.
I was just going to say that like, so this trial went on for 7 years. The victims and their families, who also had like extensive medical bills, right, hadn't seen a penny, right, and they have to have these lawyers representing them too. And like we said, people had lost providers in their family too. So they actually went to Kelso, Washington, which is in the middle of nowhere, which I thought was awesome, to this place called Western Fire Center. And the reason that they were part of the huge reason that this lawyer credits being able to win this case, because it didn't look good for a while for them, was that they recreated the entire like nightclub fire at this place called Western Fire Center. They like built the whole thing. They put in all the foam and everything, like the same kind of foam, and recreated it just to like study it and show people and film it. I don't know why they wouldn't have just shown the other video, but to like film it and like get measurements and things and say how terrible the whole thing was. That's what I was going to say about the foam. What else did you want to say about it?
Well, Brendan brought up something interesting because we were discussing it the other day, kind of in preparation for the show. But the foam on it, it says don't use it, right? That it's flammable. But Brendan explained that underneath it, it then says it indicates that it's recyclable. And the lawyers pointed out that it should have, again, after it said recyclable, reissued that exact same warning. It says a line above it.
Yeah. If you take that foam out of the packaging and you sell it and you hand it off to a third party, how do they, that, I think that was another part of it too. How, there's no way they would know either. You know what I mean? I think that was part of it too. Like if it was on the foam itself, flammable, if they put some sort of, or they dyed some sort of disclaimer in the physical foam, I think that would have made a difference too. But
I'm really glad you explained that, because before I was like, what kind of idiot is going to read something one place and then look further down the tag and not think it still applies? But right. It's printed separate places.
Well,
they should have. I think they should have.
Is that standard?
No, I heard it wrong.
Yeah.
Is that standard on foam though? Like that they print warnings on it like that?
If it's not flammable, though?
No, I don't think so. I don't think it is. I think this might have been an issue where it wasn't, you know?
Right. I don't think that is like a common practice, you know?
No.
I think that was them making a suggestion on maybe what the standard should be to avoid that situation. Did they know that was... Oh, because that guy had put that foam on the door and then the building switched hands. Right,
I think it was something like that. Yeah,
there was part of the foam put on the door, and then a sale was made. So that might have also had something to do with the third party aspect of it.
There was a couple different angles they looked at it from. The recyclable part, they mentioned it was recyclable, and if they didn't put that on it, they would have been clear. But they put that on; it's recyclable, and then the other part
going
was,
green.
Yeah.
So. Man, it's crazy. All the stuff that goes with it. And they weren't even trying to get compensated for their grief or like for their suffering or anything like that. Or yeah, just grief in general, because it's like they were just trying to get paid basically for what they had lost.
The medical
to
stuff,
get
right?
made right. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's crazy. because there's so many of them in a tragedy like that, mm-hmm. it's all going to be divided.
And with these big...
by 100.
And a third goes to the lawyers, too.
Right. Yeah.
With these big lawsuits, it's not always like, because you know a ton of these people that are getting sued are broke, too. You know what I mean? Like, the Dredarians and Great White were broke. So they wind up getting paid out by litigation funding companies who can become lenders. So picture this. There's one lady who was a widow by this fire, and she hadn't gotten any money in 7 years, so she borrowed against this money that they had coming to them and got charged interest on it at a rate of 64.7%.
Jesus.
She borrowed $100,000 or something like that.
Damn, insane. That's crazy.
Yeah. So the state actually stepped up. They set up a victim relief fund that wound up getting like $2 million. There were changes to the fire code. There's so many victims and yeah. So I don't know.
What are your thoughts on this, Gene?
Just carelessness with people's lives. It's nuts. And as far as the, I don't know, like, you think the, is the state responsible for paying when the person getting sued can't? Is that normal?
If it's the fire department, is that the state or is that the city?
The city had to pay. There's a list of like the civil litigation, which is the ones that
Well, wasn't the city sued one of the a part of this?
They were
the list of people sued. The city's not a person, but just because they should have had the inspections,
state of,
right?
The state of Rhode Island was separate as well, so they paid out $10 million. So the total outcome of the civil lawsuit was $176 million divided by
100 people, right?
Probably the 76 went to the lawyers. So it's like each person got $1 million probably.
If that, like, because they had to pay interest back for other things. And that was like after years and years. So I don't know what everyone ended up actually getting.
Can you imagine this court fees and all this shit for 7 years?
Do they give the individual... Yeah, that's right. That's true. Do they give the individual payouts for each lawsuit?
Or is it just the total? It was all consolidated into one suit. That means that each... I don't know how that part of it works. Like, if each different place or entity being sued pays out all at the same time or what... Because they did have those litigation funds set up that are like another entity in themselves that make you pay. Like, it's like a terrible creditor.
Mm.
It's weird.
We went over to the memorial, as you mentioned, to begin the show today. And it was pretty sad, you know, like it's a nice memorial. I remember when it was just like a collection of stuffed animals and signs and cards, you know, kind of just stuff that people stuck in the ground or stopped and dropped off from their car. But now they did make it a real nice area. They do have stones with most of the victims' faces on them, whichever ones they could get pictures for. Interestingly, at the far end of, like, if you go walk straight through, we're going to actually put some pictures up on the website of the memorial. We'll do a little slideshow. We took a few pictures so you guys can see what it looks like. At the far end of the memorial, there's actually a timeline of events that shows it must have like 100 square boxes, and it shows the triggering of all these events. So, like, it's pretty crazy. I was kind of shocked that they had that there, like, information about exactly what had happened, you know? Mm. I don't know, and I kind of got the chills when I just saw, like, at one point I just saw, like, three stones with the same name, and I'm like, oh, God, you know, like, that's, like, a whole family that got fucking wiped out, you know?
Well, think about, like, you go to concerts with your friends, you know?
All right.
Imagine going with your brother and sister, though, or something, and all three, you know? Like, mm-hmm. that would be, like, crazy.
Any final thoughts, guys?
Yeah, I wonder, the timeline thing, is that for, like, a tour kind of thing?
I don't know if it's just because it's a historical event, you know? It just seemed a little strange to me, though, that part.
You think
of it.
It's insensitive?
No, because I think it's the people wanted it there that...
They didn't want people to freak out what happened?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think
how it could have been avoided.
I think a lot of the people that, you know, it was like the victims that had... I'm not criticizing it. I just didn't expect to see it.
Oh.
But it's intriguing. I mean, we do this show because it's intriguing.
I hear what you're saying. You would think it would just be like a singular sort of just memorial for the victims, not a time. I know what you're saying, though, yeah.
But if that's what the family thought would be good, then
that's what they agreed
Maybe they're just trying to create like awareness so it doesn't happen again, you know?
Yeah, I think...
I can see that, yeah.
I think like the one good thing that did come out of this is... all of the fire training and things that people get and just knowing how fast things can happen and just letting it be like an example of what to avoid. And I think that having that timeline there, because it does break it down, like how we watched that minute and a half and that's all it took, you know, like how long does it take you to take a shit at work? You know what I mean? Like that's
comes
all
right out. it's really wet.
Takes Aaron 10 times that long.
It just in a flash.
I have to wait for my anus to blossom like a flower in spring. But no,
so it's prolapse.
In all seriousness, though, it's fucking sad that it took the loss of 100 lives, the horrific deformities of hundreds of others, and the hearts breaking of probably thousands of others, for us to get that training that they have now. But
yeah,
and I'll add that they won the case, but that's, what was it, like $1 million each?
If that
that ain't shit, especially if you have like multiple kids and shit. I think I read somewhere that it takes like about like $500,000 just to raise a like fucking kid until he's 18.
Well, that's if you want like healthy non-retarded boy.
Yeah,
you know,
but I ain't shit. That sucks.
This is a tough one.
Yo, can we have a happy episode?
Right?
Just happy shit.
There's gotta be some happy evil stuff that happens, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Happy evil stuff.
Well, I thought this was a good one, though. Thanks for joining us on this one, Brendan.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
The insight in the last couple episodes too. The insight was very valuable. Mm-hmm. Looking at your face is quite entertaining as well.
thanks. How about the beard? Is it coming in? I was telling you about it at work.
Yeah.
Is you the guy think it's coming in dope? Yeah.
Yeah.
Very nice.
I'm gonna let it actually like. I want to get it like John the Skeptics. Like
salt and pepper, John the Skeptic.
Yeah. I want to. Yeah.
Rivals.
Well, guys, again, that's www.evilexamine.com. We'll put up a slideshow for you of the monument, so you can check it out.
Follow us on Facebook.
Yeah, follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Also, I'm going to put up the documentary, Doorway to Hell, because that one is extremely interesting. And maybe at some point, maybe in the future, we'll even do an episode on that. We'll dedicate this episode to the victims and the families of the victims. And until next week, good evening. I don't think I mean,
everybody else was in there against their will.